So what I'd like to do is present a very rapid overview of some research in the field of developmental neuroscience that I think might be particularly relevant for considering children in the context of the legal framework. Now, one of the specific areas that we know is relevant for thinking about children in the law is the age of criminal responsibility, currently set at age 10 in England. And that implies that children of age 10 are mature both to be able to stand trial, but also to be responsible in the same way as adults for their actions. And I know that both Laura and Eileen will be expanding and considering other ways in which children interface with the law in their talk shortly. But what is the magic age of 10? That was a question posed by Professor Glanville Williams in 1978, and in many ways it remains a pertinent question even now. And what I'd like to suggest is that the emerging literature in developmental neuroscience in particular, as well as in developmental psychology more generally, is providing a way to possibly contextualise that question and make it less arbitrary than it once was. But as has just been suggested, how these two domains may interface is a question for us to consider. So my first proposition is that across neurocognitive domains, a child of 10 is developmentally and neurocognitively immature. And we can think about development at a number of levels. At the cognitive level, we know that adolescents undergo a wide number of changes across multiple domains and being able to plan, process social and emotional cues. And the key area is in how they moderate peer influence. So we know that risk-taking changes significantly during the adolescent period. And Laurie Steinberg and colleagues in the States have carried out a number of very elegant studies where they have looked at risk-taking using these simulated kind of video games, which allow you to quantify a level of risk-taking. And what you can see here is that adults, when they play these kind of games, take no more risks when they play the game alone compared to when they play these kind of games in the presence of another adult. So they're largely immune to the influence of a peer. The pattern is very different for adolescents. As you can see, they make a comparable number of risky decisions when they play the game alone as an adult would. And this is confirmed by lots of other studies showing that adolescents generally are able to give quite sensible answers to questions around risk. However, when they play the game in the presence of a peer, their level of risk-taking significantly increases. Now, what neuroscience is starting to help us understand is the neural basis for these kind of behavioural changes. And these researchers have been able to identify what happens in the brain when adolescents are making these risky decisions with their peers present, and we know that they show increased activation of the ventral striatum, an area which we know to be highly implicated in reward processing. And it seems that when adolescents take these kind of risky decisions in the presence of peers, that risk-taking is a more rewarding experience. That's what this kind of research implies. But of course, this is just one of a wide range of areas that we're beginning to learn about in terms of developmental neuroscience across a range of domains in emotional and behavioural regulation. We know that adolescents are undergoing significant neurocognitive development, so that a child of 10 is, in my view, not comparable to an adult in terms of their neurocognitive functioning. There's also an evidence in relation to structural development of the brain, which we don't have time to cover now, but in some there is evidence for protracted development of the frontal cortex, which we know, again, is important in some of these higher order behavioural and emotional processes. So in essence, adolescence is characterised by a marked process of development at the neurocognitive level. And that's typical adolescence. That's a process we've all gone through. Now, my second proposition focuses on the impact of maltreatment and adversity that is experienced by a subset of adolescents. And the proposition is that that maltreatment experience amplifies risk-taking and amplifies vulnerability in children. And we know that from epidemiological evidence that shows that children who experience maltreatment are at significantly elevated risk for psychiatric mental health problems as well as conduct problems. So this is the framework for developmental science, but it's very important not to omit the influence of the environment, and for children, the experience of family life is a highly influential influence, and environment can act at the neurobiological and psychological levels. And one of the key messages that is emerging from the research is that maltreatment serves to sensitise children to threat cues in their environment. So these children become hypervigilant to threat in their environment, and this may be adaptive for them in the short term in being able to manage in abusive and erratic home environments. But that adaptation seems to increase risk for later psychiatric and behavioural problems in the longer term. Now, this is relevant for the legal framework because a significant minority of children in custody come from families where they will have experienced different forms of maltreatment. And the literature is relatively established now demonstrating structural differences in the brain in children who've experienced maltreatment. And there is an emerging but still smaller literature documenting differences at the functional level, how the brain responds to different kinds of stimuli. One of the ways we can help, we can use to interpret the literature is by looking at other kinds of research areas where they have looked at the impact of development, looked at the impact of environmental adversity, and the study of soldiers is one very comparable area because you're able to carry out longitudinal research with soldiers and scan soldiers before and after they've been deployed in combat and see how their brains show patterns of adaptation. And that's not possible with developmental samples of children who've experienced maltreatment, because obviously you wouldn't want to expose children in that way. Now, we published a study at the end of last year looking at a group of children, all of whom had been referred to Islington Social Services. We were asking a very basic question about how they processed affective cues, facial expressions, in particular interested in seeing their response to threat cues such as angry faces and comparing it with other forms of affect. We find significant differences in two key brain regions, the amygdala, which is implicated in threat detection, and the anterior insula, which is implicated in anticipating future pain. Now, what was very striking for us was that these are precisely the same areas that you see in soldiers who have been exposed to combat. Now, this isn't my diagram, this is the diagram from Wingen and colleagues. Essentially, these soldiers before and after they were deployed to Afghanistan show changes in two regions, the amygdala and the anterior insula. So obviously, the environmental adversity that these individuals experience are quite different, but both sets of individuals appear to show a pattern of adaptation to that environmental threat, which may be adaptive. So the idea is that maltreatment may cause alterations in functional brain architecture, which may have short-term adaptive consequences, but in the longer term, in adolescence and in adulthood, may increase vulnerability for mental health problems and conduct problems. So there's emerging evidence that childhood maltreatment is associated with atypical neural development, and this may serve to compound the vulnerability that one sees in normative adolescent development. So to conclude, I would suggest that there is now a body of emerging neurocognitive research that means we're able to characterise with increasing objectivity the developmental maturity of children and adolescents. And there is now preliminary evidence that younger children who've experienced maltreatment and early adversity may be doubly disadvantaged by virtue of their immaturity at the developmental level and heightened neurocognitive risk. And I would suggest that although these remain separate domains, there should be at least a way in which we can begin a dialogue, and this research should begin to at least inform how we treat children within the criminal justice system.